My name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is the second series in a four-part series on Jesus and power, in which the effort is to strike a conversation between some new looks at Jesus at the turn of the millennium and our experience of power in what I think is a new age of human power. Yesterday we probed a bit about our experience of power and made some efforts at a definition. Today we're going to look at the other pole of the conversation, a bit about a look at Jesus. Tomorrow morning, come back to our situation again and try to do some in-depth look in answer to a question: is ours a new era of human power? And then tomorrow evening, try to put the two together theologically, with a final session put to the question: is this a new era for God's power? Okay, so let's begin. Some of you know the writing of Zora Neale Hurston. She's one of the great American writers. The inspiration of Alice Walker. Some of you know The Color Purple. Zora Neale Hurston's book, which I have found a total delight, is entitled Their Eyes Were Watching God. And it's her story as an ethnographer, as well as a literary figure, of rural life in the 1920s and the 1930s in the little outback Black American settlements just inland from the east coast of Florida. As you know, if you grew up in a small town, many of the great philosophical and theological conversations happen on store porches. Every morning, she writes, the world flung itself over and exposed the town to the sun. This is a wonderful image. Then Lige and Sam and Walter, or some of the other big picture talkers, using a side of the world for a canvas, would gather to discuss the day's events. Sometimes they talked about power and about Jesus, though more often about the mayor. And she writes, there was no doubt the town respected the mayor and even admired the mayor in a way. But anyone who walks in the way of power and property is bound to meet hate. So when speakers stood up when the occasion demanded and said, our beloved mayor, it was one of those statements that everybody says but no one actually believes, like God is everywhere. It was just a handle to wind up the tongue with. Well, with insight like that, I hesitate to address the topic of Jesus and power. It's probably just big picture talking. And the occasion now to say what everybody says, but no one actually believes, like God is everywhere, or our beloved mayor. But let's go at it anyway. We finished yesterday, and this isn't a summary, it's just telling you where we finished, by offering some general propositions. One that, in a generic or an inclusive understanding of power, is power as the capacity to change, endure, or conserve some state of affairs. The capacity to change it, endure it, or conserve some state of affairs. Secondly, that nothing evil ever happens apart from power. Thirdly, that nothing good ever happens apart from power. Nothing good ever happens apart from power. Fourthly, nothing happens apart from power. And we might have added a fifth characteristic. I don't have a formulation of it, but the reference is to the omnipresence of power. And I have put a quotation on the board, which I will read to you, about social power. It would pertain to other forms as well, but this is about social power. Every social act is an exercise of power. Every social relationship is a power equation. And every social group or system is an organization of power. Power occurs anytime there is more than one human being on the same patch of real estate. Anytime there's a relation between them, power is present. Wherever two or three are gathered, power is in the midst of them, if I may paraphrase. Now, I've already shifted the subject, and I've done that intentionally, from a generic look at power to social power in particular, and I'm going to make one more shift, and that is going to be to social power around Jesus of Nazareth. There are other dimensions of the ministry, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. I'm not excluding those. I'm focusing on the experience of power by those who met Yehoshua ben Joseph, Miriam's son, from the region of Galilee, Jesus of Nazareth. And for many of them, that experience of power, and I think probably especially for the women, was an experience of social power, the likes of which they had not experienced. And it's that power of Jesus, and that Jesus of power, that I want to look at tonight. Okay. Let's stay with this a little bit. If we say Jesus in the title Jesus in Power, it might refer to several different things. It might, as I just indicated, it can, it does mean that putting those two words together, Jesus in Power, is the experience of those in the midst of Jesus, and the experience of the early church. And we don't have time here now. Sometime I would like to see with someone just do a word study of how often power is used about Jesus and how often Paul uses it about the experience of the new reality in Christ. What we could make the biblical case now that power is the agenda of Jesus and power is the experience of Jesus by those closest to him. We could, and power does, refer to the state of recent biblical scholarship. Jesus and power, that combination, is what is emphasized in many a new look at Jesus by those who study the parties and choices of the concrete setting in which the ministry of Jesus occurs. And maybe we'll have a little time later to talk about the parties in Palestine under Roman rule, the power dynamics within Palestine, and the power dynamics between parties in Judaism and the occupying power, Rome, and locate Jesus amidst the power dynamics and facing the possible power choices. That is a way we can talk about it, and we might a little bit. But there's a third way, and that's where we'll give the attention. I must simply select a thread of this new look at Jesus, pick just a couple authors who are rather fascinated with this Jewish figure, precisely because of what he offers for our power choices and our experience of power today. Both of these figures that I'm going to spend a little time with are competent biblical scholars. In fact, that is their training. But their motivation for digging deeper is because of what around them as late 20th century citizens is spoken to by the Jesus they find. So I'm going to focus then finally on the social power of Jesus, our social and political power of Jesus, and introduce you simply to a slender slice, thin slice. I don't know if slices can be slender. Thin slice of scholarship on this. Let me do the commercial at this point and say that one of the authors is available in the bookstore, Pinchas Lapid. The book is entitled The Sermon on the Mount. The subtitle is Utopia or Program for Action? Pinchas Lapid, L-I-P-I-D-E, The Sermon on the Mount, on a table in the bookstore. The other book, and the one I'll be using most directly, even though it gathers a consensus from Lapid, is by Walter Wink, put it up here as well, Violence and Nonviolence in South Africa, Jesus' Third Way. That's not in the bookstore, it's just off the press. I expect that it will be well used at Holden. A word about each of these two. Pinchas Lapid wrote an article in Evangelisches Kommentar, German magazine, German Lutheran and Calvinist magazine. It was entitled, What Did Jesus Ask? And it was a preliminary sketch of what is now the fuller treatment of the Sermon on the Mount. I find it fascinating because Pinchas Lapid is an Orthodox Jew writing in Germany about Jesus. He fought against the Germans as a member of the British regiment in the Second World War. He now has gone to Germany in a kind of vocation of fostering fostering Jewish-Christian relations. He was motivated to this in part because of the peace movement among young people in Germany, many of whom came from the churches, and Pinchas Lapid thought the Christians didn't know what they had for the peace movement with their Jesus. So he wrote this article. There was a response to it. And it led to a debate on German television between Pinchas Lapid and Hans Appel, who was the defense minister in the state of Germany. It also led to a request from Kaiser Wilhelm Verlag to write a book-length manuscript, and that's what we have now in translation. He also wrote a book on the resurrection of Jesus and a few other things. But his point was that there is a reality in the way of Jesus that is a power for peace. But, I mean, this is always sort of amusing. Here you've got a Jew asking Christians to take Jesus seriously. A little bit like Gandhi, a Hindu, asking Christians to take Jesus seriously, specifically the Jesus of the Sermon on the Mount. I don't know how many of you saw the Gandhi movie, but there's this wonderful scene where he and his friend, Charles Andrews, who's an Episcopalian, an Anglican priest, are walking down the street and they confront a couple of bullies, and Gandhi will not be stopped by this, and they continue on, and Gandhi says to Andrews something about the Sermon on the Mount, turning the other cheek and so on, and Andrews, well, I think it was used metaphorically, but Gandhi just takes it seriously, see, and then you end up with a Christian clergyman trying to apologize for a different rendering of the Sermon on the Mount than the Hindu insists upon. All right. You'll be interested in this book because at the very outset he shares 8 misinterpretations of the Sermon on the Mount, and I defy you to go through church history without finding all 8 of them prominent. And that's just his way of opening up how the Sermon on the Mount looks from the point of view of a Jew who sees Jesus as a fellow Jew. Jesus was a Jew and not a Christian, and so it's a fresh, for us, perspective. All right, Walter Wink is a New Testament scholar who has done the most work recently on the whole subject of power in the New Testament. He is finishing a 3-volume work entitled The Powers. Fortress Press is publishing it. The first volume was entitled Naming the Powers. Second volume was entitled Unmasking the Powers. And the third volume is in process, and it's entitled Engaging the Powers. He takes the findings of the first 2 volumes and then takes issues in our time, like militarism, and joins in dialogue, something like we're trying to do here. This little volume is a portion of that third volume, and he's taking his knowledge of from work in South Africa and engaging that issue, thus violence and nonviolence in South Africa, Jesus' third way. There is amazing agreement between Lapid and Wink by way of independent work, both of them first-class exegetes, that is, working with the texts, knowing their background, knowing the backgrounds of the text, etc. They work independently, but I'm drawing on both of them, even though it's a bit redundant, and I'll use Wink primarily. Okay, so we're going to focus on the Sermon on the Mount as a further telescoping of the topic of how Jesus responds to evil or oppressive power and the experience of Jesus as a social and political force. As I said before, there's no claim in all of this that the meaning of Jesus is reduced to that particular focus. I happened to be reading in the Christian Century today an article by Martin Marty, and came across some further interesting comments on the Sermon on the Mount, and I think I just better share them, because Lapid and Wink are not typical here. More common is the contention that the Sermon on the Mount does not represent political and social power and is not a program for action. Both Wink and Lapid argue that, but at least I ought to pass on from Marty a more typical view. He first recalls that President Truman liked to say that American life should be ruled by the Sermon on the Mount. Lapid and Wink and Marty would all be a little aghast at the notion. And then Marty rather mocks that contention and says, "Picture that ethic legislated. We would have a nation of 200 million plus amputees, right eyes and right hands being removed from all but the listless and the lustless. We would also, of course, have a nation without weapons, though it is not likely that we would follow Jesus that far. We would rather employ some well-paid government exegetes to obscure those sorts of commands while asserting the militant ones of the theocracy." So, Marty. Incidentally, it was none other than Omar Bradley, who at the time was the United States' only 5-star general, who, reflecting upon our age of weaponry, the power of weaponry of our age, said, "We must somehow learn to live by the Sermon on the Mount, or we'll all perish together." Lapide and Wink would agree, but their attention is to a different group of folks than President Truman's or Omar Bradley. The attention of Lapide and Wink is to the people who are relatively powerless, not the established powerful figures, because they see that that is Jesus' audience. That is their contention. It makes all the difference whom is being addressed when you read the Sermon on the Mount. All right. Let's finish this what my speech teacher used to call extended introduction. Finish this extended introduction by just saying one more thing, and that is to put the Sermon on the Mount in somewhat larger, if still inadequate, context, by noting that the larger sketch of the ministry of Jesus is one in which there is a coupling of suffering and power. And I just want to draw three kinds of distinctions around that word suffering, what it can mean. It can mean finding meaning in suffering that comes your way. You didn't ask for it. It does come your way. It's part of the human drama that unrequested suffering comes our way. One meaning of suffering and power is the power to somehow wrest some meaning from that uncalled for and unwanted suffering. There is power in that. As Nietzsche, a critic of Christianity, acknowledged, people who live with a meaning can endure most anything. So one can seek meaning, and there is power in finding meaning in suffering come our way. There is a second connection of suffering and power. One can expect suffering in pursuing justice. One can expect suffering in pursuing the good, because it is not often experienced as the good or as justice by others, or it is a threat to them. The third possible link of suffering and power is that one can seek to discredit and end all suffering that perpetuates victimization and powerlessness of various kinds. One can seek the power, or one can seek to exercise power, that discredits and ends suffering that makes for other suffering. One can seek to use power to get rid of the powerlessness and the suffering it brings. My contention is that all three of those are to be seen in the ministry of Jesus. Resting, the power to wrest meaning from suffering that comes one's way, an expectation that suffering is going to be met if one walks the way of the cross, and pursues justice for the least. And third, there is in Jesus that drive to see the reign of God, the characteristic of which there will be no more tears, and there will be no more victims.
Larry, would you just remind, restating two?
Two, one can expect suffering in walking the way of Jesus. Okay, that is an effort to set a somewhat larger framework Now I want to go to the Sermon on the Mount, and I'm going to draw from Walter Wink's comments here a few pages. We've got, say, 10 minutes or so and to hear him out, and then we can turn to some discussion. He, in these pages, doesn't deal with the Sermon on the Mount as a whole, but only with a few verses. The context of his discussion is lots of talk with people in South Africa and a whole lot of study of the South African scene. The probable ineffective turn to violent rebellion and attempt at revolution is what motivates, in part, Wink's turn to the Sermon on the Mount. He doesn't think it's a practical possibility in South Africa because of military power and a tremendous system of informing, a tremendous system of intelligence puts all the power in the hands of the police and the military. So he's looking for some other way. But he says that Jesus' third way is a way between, on the one hand, fight. That is not the characteristic of Jesus. If by fight you mean promoting armed revolt, violent rebellion, direct retaliation, and revenge, that's not the way that he sees in the Sermon on the Mount. Nor is it a second possibility that people often turn to in the face of crushing and evil uses of power. That second alternative is flight. Flight is characterized by submission, somehow coping with this situation, by submitting to it and doing the best with it. Flight is characterized by passivity. Flight is characterized by withdrawal. Flight is characterized by surrender. He sees nothing of submission, passivity, surrender, or withdrawal in Jesus, facing the choices Jesus faced. Nor does he see fight. That was an option that was urged upon Jesus, and some of his disciples came from the ranks of the zealots, who were among those that were preparing for the fight alternative. All right, let's look at a few verses in the Sermon on the Mount. If you want to look later, I'm going to be working from chapter 2 in Walter Wink's book. We'll just take these verses. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil. But if anyone strikes you in the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. From Matthew 5. Walter first starts out by working with the Greek, as does Pinchas Lapide, to say that the term that is rendered resist not evil there doesn't do us justice. It doesn't do justice in the first instance because there is absolutely nothing in the whole ministry of Jesus which would back that up. Jesus never refuses to resist evil. His whole ministry is resisting evil in one way or another. The word in Greek for resist is a word which in other contexts has exactly the connotations of armed revolt, that kind of resistance, of revenge, that kind of resistance, of direct retaliation, that kind of resistance. And it is in fact rendered in other places in the New Testament, I think Paul does, in ways that Wink thinks that we ought to change what we've gotten from the King James Version, where it just stops, resist not evil. What it means is resist not evil in kind. Resist not evil with evil. Resist not evil in the way in which it has been meted to you. And particularly these kinds of things are usually connoted. It usually refers to a lethal use of power as a way of resistance. So it's do not strike back at evil in kind. Do not give blow for blow. Do not retaliate against violence with violence. All right, let's go to some attention to these little verses. Do not, if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. I should interject something that Lapid and Wink both make much of, the audience of Jesus. The people who were attracted into the Jesus movement were not all simply the poor, although there were predominantly the poor, and in Galilee, because of some debt problems and land structure and refugee issues, there were an awfully lot of homeless, unrooted people who were attracted to the Jesus movement. There were other people who were marginalized in the society. They weren't necessarily the poor, but they did not have much social standing, and they were often despised by many. I'm thinking of tax collectors, for example, or prostitutes, or women who, because of the patriarchal character of the society, had very little social power and social standing. And it's to these that Jesus is speaking in the judgment of these scholars. Also the humble poor who have been waiting now century upon century for the inbreaking of God's reign and a change in fortune. All the more astonishing then that you get these kinds of instructions from Jesus. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. But a closer look. Why the right cheek? How does one strike another on the right cheek, anyway? Try it. If you take a blow by the right fist in that right-handed world, you'll hit the left cheek of the person. To strike the right cheek with the fist would require using the left hand. But if any of you know, not only was it the case then, but it is in many societies now, the left hand is used only for unclean tasks. That you don't use your left hand for that kind of, except for one thing. We won't talk about that. Even at Qumran, the community of those who did try to withdraw and wait for the kingdom, at Qumran at this time, even to gesture with the left hand carried the penalty of 10 days. Penance. You just didn't use your left hand. The only way one can strike the right cheek with the right hand is to use the back of the hand, which in that context is a gesture of extreme insult. The intention is not to injure, the intention is to humiliate. The intention is to put people in their place. That's what you do with the right hand. You strike with the back of it to the cheek in order to put people in their place. You don't ordinarily do that to a peer, wouldn't do that to your colleague. You do that to someone who is subordinate to you. If you did do it to a peer, there was an exorbitant price that you had to pay, the penalty. It was a normal way of admonishing inferiors. Masters backhanded their slaves. Husbands backhanded their wives in that day. Parents sometimes used the back of the hand on the kids, and Romans backhanded Jews. What we've got, Wink says, and Lapide, is a set of unequal relations, people with vastly different degrees of power. But the inferior party in this subordinate inferior business has so little power relative to the other that a direct retaliation of the same kind was out of the question. He says, Lapide says, it would be suicidal. So the usual response was a kind of cowering commission, submission, not fight, but usually flight. And Walter passes on the conversation he had with the black South Africans working on the farms of white Afrikaners who said their bosses still sometimes use the back of the hand to bring them to the point of proper submission. But what you've got here then are among Jesus' listeners are not those who are striking. Jesus isn't talking to them. But they're victims. If anyone strikes you, turn the other cheek. Sues you, don't go to court. Forces you, go another mile. Now that sounds like further humiliation and further submission, accepting your place. But according to Lapide and Wink, what you have going here is that if the oppressor backhands you and you turn the other cheek, you're in effect saying, try again, your first blow failed to humiliate me. I will not go to that place. I am a human being, just like you. Your status doesn't alter that fact. You cannot demean me. That's what turning the other cheek does. there's a rather amusing side of this. Walter goes on to say, such a response couldn't create enormous difficulties for the striker. Purely logistically, how do you now hit the other cheek? You can't backhand it with your right hand. If you hit with a fist, you've made that person an equal, acknowledging the other as a peer. But the whole point of the back of the hand is to reinforce the caste system and the institutionalized inequality. Even if you order the person flogged, the point has been irrevocably made. You've been forced against your will to regard that person as a human being. You've been stripped of your power to dehumanize the other. All right, I don't want us to run out of time to respond to these people. So let's quickly go to the second example. Someone is being sued for his or her garment. Here again, or if anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. Here again, you've got the situation as follows. It's a matter of compassion, as recorded in the Old Testament, that if a poor person owes a richer person, the richer person can take what the poor person has, even their clothing, but when nightfall comes, you have to give the cloak back to them because they must not. It's inhumane to have them sleep in the cold without their cloak. And then Jesus turns around and says, against this kind of compassionate provision, if they take your cloak, give them your coat, ask for your coat, give them your cloak also. It's only the poorest of the poor who would have nothing but an honor garment to give as collateral for the loan. And then you have this Jewish law about its return at evening, at sunset. It sounds like the poor are asked to be sunk even ever deeper into poverty when they can't repay their debt, and the creditors hauled them into court to try and wring out the repayment by legal means. Wink and Lapide both go on to show that indebtedness was the most serious social problem in the Palestine of the first centuries. And if you go through the parables of Jesus, you'll find out they're full of debtors struggling to salvage their lives. But it was a direct result of the arrangements in the economy that you had this situation of great indebtedness. And it goes through the ranks, from the Romans and through the Jews on down through kind of socioeconomic caste system. It'll be of interest to you that the first act when Jewish revolutionaries did try fight instead of flight in 66 BC or CE, the first act was to burn the temple treasury. Jews burning the temple treasury. Why? Because that's where all the records of debts were kept. Now, in this context, Jesus speaks. His hearers are the poor. If anyone would sue you, poor people. They hate the system. It stripped them of their lands and their goods, and now finally their garments. And then Jesus tells them to give over their last garment as well. That would mean stripping off all their clothing and marching out of court stark naked. And this is the kind of scene that is portrayed by Wink. Stay with me just a minute here. I'll just read directly. Put yourself in the debtor's place and imagine the chuckles this saying must have evoked. There stands the creditor, beet red with embarrassment, your outer garment in the one hand, your underwear in the other. You have suddenly turned the tables on him. You have no hope of winning the trial. There wasn't a chance of that in the first place. The law was entirely in the creditor's favor, but you've refused to be humiliated, and at the same time, you've registered a stunning protest against a system that spawns such debt. You've said, in effect, you want my robe? Here, take everything. Now you've got all I have except my body. Is that what you'll take next? But nakedness was taboo in Jerusalem, and shame fell not on the naked party, but on the person viewing or causing the nakedness. By stripping, you have brought the creditor under the same prohibition that led to the curse of Canaan. As you parade into the streets, your friends and neighbors, startled, aghast, inquire what happened. You explain. They join your growing procession, which now resembles a victory parade. The entire system by which debtors are oppressed has been publicly en masse. The creditor is revealed to be not a respectable money lender, but a party in the reduction of an entire social class to landlessness and destitution. It offers the creditor, too, a chance to see, perhaps for the first time, what the practices cause. Jesus is, in effect, Wink says, sponsoring clowning. In so doing, he shows himself.
Also, the other part of it, if you're going to talk, somebody's got to listen. So to put those two skills together, knowing when to listen and when to talk. To own our own feelings, that's an important tool.
On to talk here. The powers that be literally stand on their dignity. Nothing depotentiates them faster than deft lampooning. By refusing to be awed by their power, the powerless are emboldened to seize the initiative, even when where structural change is not possible. These are powerless folks. They can't change the system. This message, don't sue, give them your cloak, far from being a counsel of perfection unattainable in this life, is a practical strategic measure for empowering the oppressed, even though it's by way of burlesque. All right, then... Finally, one more little example here on going the second mile. Some of you are familiar with this. It was the prerogative of Roman soldiers to conscript Jews to carry their baggage for a mile. At the end of the mile, then the Roman soldiers had no longer had a right to ask the Jews to carry their baggage. And Jesus is saying, if a soldier asks you to carry your bag, the soldier's pack, 1 mile, at the end of the mile, you say, oh, let me carry another mile. Why would you do that? What are you up to? Being kind? Planning to file a complaint? Are you trying to create trouble? What's going on here? You've taken the power of choice away from the person who represents the power over you. You've seized the moral initiative. You've caught the person off guard. You've changed the relationship between you, the victim, and the one who represents power of the state, indeed the power of the sword. Lapide has a lovely description of this. He says that when you tally up the Sermon on the Mount injunctions and look at the relationships that they encourage by the poor and the oppressed toward their oppressors and toward the rich, it amounts to a procedure of what Lapide calls de-hostilizing love. De-hostilizing love. You've changed the relationship. Some of it's by buffoonery and embarrassment. Some of it is by an unexpected gesture on your part. But we won't go through all of those examples. I am going to simply read what I put on the board here and ask you to think about other episodes in the Gospels or in the teachings of Jesus, parables, for example, which also reflect these. Jesus' third way, according to Wink and Lapide, is a way which now is addressed to people, first of all, who are marginalized at the edge, inferior by the society's standards, social status, women tax collectors, the poor, etc. And given that audience, Jesus' teachings and actions come down to these show these characteristics. They let those people seize the moral initiative. They find a creative alternative to violence. Can't fight? You haven't got the power. Flight is what you've always been doing. That leaves you where you were. But find a creative alternative to violence. Three, assert your own humanity and dignity as a person. Anybody remember the signs in Memphis where Martin Luther King was assassinated? He went there for a garbage strike. What was the sign everyone was carrying? Garbage workers happened to all be male.
I am a man.
That's all it said. You've got to contend with that. I am a man. Assert your own humanity and dignity as a person. Walter mentions the fact that a great step was taken toward the breaking of the apartheid system when the black domestic workers in the white Afrikaner homes quit calling their boss, boss, or mister. As soon as that woman could call her employer by a first name, his first name, or her first name, employer, something happened in the movement to break that oppression. Or when all of those high school kids in Soweto lined up after the government told them they had to learn Afrikaans, the language of the oppressor, they marched out, they went out in front of the schools, they refused to go to school, the policemen came, the soldiers came, and the kids said, all you can do is kill us. That's all you can do. At that moment, the sovereignty of the South African government was profoundly broken. When 700 kids marched to jail in Birmingham, high school kids singing "We're on Our Way to Freedom Land," a whole lot of desegregation fell. They had seized the moral initiative, they had found a creative alternative to violence, they had asserted their own humanity and dignity as persons. Meet force with ridicule or humor. Break the cycle of humiliation. Refuse to submit or accept the inferior position. Expose the injustice of the system. Giving your underwear in court. Take control of the power dynamic. Shift it. It's not just over there. Some of it is where you are. Shame the oppressor into repentance. Stand your ground. Make the powers make decisions for which they're not prepared. Put them in a situation they're not ready to deal with. And then put the ball in their court. Recognize your own power. Be willing to suffer rather than retaliate. Force the oppressor to see you in a new light. Going the second mile. Soldier never saw the Jew that he'd harassed to do that in that light before. Derive the oppressor of a situation where a show of force is effective. That is, a show of force on the terms of the oppressor. Be willing to undergo the penalty of breaking unjust law. Show you're not criminal, you're respecting the rule of law. So you are willing to undergo the penalty of breaking unjust laws. Die to fear of the old order and its rules. Jesus lived as though God reigns and no one else had any power over him. Jesus lived as though God reigns and no one else had any power over him. And on its better days, there weren't a lot of them, so did the early church. But that requires some empowerment, and this third way is a way of doing that. Okay, now I have gone on longer than I said I would, but there is still some time to register your response. My purpose in this session was to take another, and I hope a kind of fresh look at Jesus by way of a couple of scholars who spend some time with the text, and to do so in order to spark your interest in a much larger topic, namely to look at the whole life, death, ministry, resurrection of Jesus in terms of power. This is one snippet. Yes?
Number six is troubling.
Number six is refuse to submit or accept the inferior position.
It seems to be at odds with the
I'm so glad you brought that up. I would like us at this or some other point to take a very long look at our images of servant and our reading of Jesus as the suffering servant, and to look at power in light of that, because I suspect that our readings of Jesus as servant really, in the end, come down to a reading of servant in terms of flight, submission, passivity. When we push it a long time, it ends up in a kind of slave morality, and servant ends up being having the characteristics of slave. Do you want to say some more about that?
I would only ask for a clarification before scholar.
There's some
what biblical evidence do you have that that is Jesus' third way?
You mean number six?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something profound about the whole image of servant, although that's not exactly what number six, refused to submit or accept the inferior position. My kind of educated guess is that you what you in fact have is Jesus constantly breaking the picture of the position that others want him to hold. That is, he doesn't stay in the place that others want him to have.
Continues to carry it back.
Yeah. But it goes several ways, including those who want him to be king. And he turns that one down, too. He's very reticent about being Messiah because of the pictures of Messiah that people have. Other people are constantly giving him titles. He generally declines them. And in an amazing little episode about power, he talks about the kind of power that he represents as contrasted with other kinds of power, including those that people want to ascribe to him. I'm referring to Mark 10 and Matthew 20. And I want people at least to consider this. The whole picture of servant needs to be reread not as a picture of powerlessness, but as a picture of an alternative mode of power. Without the characteristics of flight, however.
What about persons who take on this cost but who are not in that position? Like Rudy says, coming up to you as Gerald was Indian fishing night.
What?
What about persons who are not in the position of inferiority,
yeah,
but take on the cause?
Oh.
And I suspect for their own grandishment.
Sometimes. If we just want to get down to an analysis of power dynamics here, it is worth noting that the leadership for the kinds of movements that Wink and Lapid see happening in the Sermon on the Mount, and which I made allusion to when I mentioned Martin King and Gandhi. The leadership for that kind of thing usually comes from people who know two worlds, the world of the marginalized and the world of the powerful, the world of the powerless and the world of the powerful. And they are people who are capable of calling out power from the powerless, calling forth the power the powerless did not know they had, on the one hand, that is empowering them, and on the other hand, knowing how the system works, so as to be shrewd in the use of power. Martin King came from the Deep South, came from middle-class black family, got his PhD at Boston University, but grew up in the black church. Cesar Chavez, another example. Gandhi, English lawyer, for heaven's sakes, ended up finally going back to the villages and spinning his own cloth and living like that, but knew two worlds. And who's the archetype here? Moses. Pharaoh's court. And not forgetting his people. So sometimes you have all sorts of hangers-on who may be there for their own aggrandizement. Other times, it may be that they represent, some of those folks represent, a knowledge of two worlds. And I think the most important question to ask is, with whom do they identify? Whom are they empowering? Let me finally just cite an example from Jesus' own time that I found intriguing, because it's from not from the New Testament, it's from the history that Josephus put together, but it's about Pilate. Pilate had brought the imperial standards into Jerusalem, that is, Caesar's standards, flags into Jerusalem, displayed them at the fortress Antonio overlooking the temple. All of Jerusalem was in tumult about this, partly because it represents a violation of Jewish law, since Caesar represents gods as well, and now you've got images of the false, wrong god there. Pilate brings them in. The Jews come to Pilate through their leaders and request their removal. Pilate refuses. A large crowd of Jews fell prostrate, and this is what Josephus is writing now, from the time of Jesus, around his house, and for 5 whole days and nights remained motionless in that position. On the 6th day, Pilate assembled the multitude in the stadium with the apparent intention of answering them. Instead, his soldiers surrounded the Jews in a ring 3 deep. As Josephus tells it, Pilate, after threatening to cut them down if they refused to admit Caesar's images, signaled to the soldiers to draw their swords. Thereupon the Jews, as by concerted actions, flung themselves in a body on the ground, extended their necks, and exclaimed that they were ready to die rather than transgress the law. Overcome with astonishment at such intense religious zeal, Pilate gave orders for the immediate removals of the standards from Jerusalem. It was happening at those times, and the Jesus movement is one of those movements. It requires, above all, dying to fear of the old order and its rules. And its source of power is the confidence that God reigns and no one else has power over one. Thank you.